Chapter 17, Headstrong Beauty. On the 23rd of September 2003, a small team of Iraqi police and US military personnel made its way to a farmhouse north of Baghdad. Armed with weapons, shovels, and a tip-off, they were on the hunt for one of the most treasured artifacts plundered from the National Museum of Iraq in the aftermath of the US-led invasion. Following what was reported to be a brisk but intense interrogation of the householder, the team began digging beneath fruit trees behind the house. They soon unearthed a plastic bag. Inside, wrapped in cloth, was an almost life-sized marble face. Large almond-shaped eye sockets sat under long, stylized brows. Neat, scalloped waves curled on the forehead. Gently rounded cheeks framed a regal nose, albeit chipped in an ancient accident. A small, delicate mouth was set above a petite chin. They had found the famed Lady of Uruk. Dated to about 3100 BCE, this striking face originally belonged in the vast temple complex of the Sumerian goddess Inanna at Uruk, perhaps the world's earliest city. Located in the desert plain between the Tigris and Euphrates in southern Mesopotamia, the site had been a home to both humans and otherworldly beings since at least 5000 BCE, but by 3100 BCE, it housed thousands of mortals and a plethora of gods, among whom Inanna was one of the most prominent. Her temple precinct was known as Eanna, House of Heaven, and it really was heavenly. On three terraced platforms stood perfectly proportioned limestone temples and cool, airy buildings, interlinked by shady pavilions of colourful brickwork, wide monumental staircases, and a large courtyard open to the skies. A fat columned portico rose from one terrace to the next, each of its giant pillars decorated with a geometric mosaic of coloured cones painted black, red, and white. For Inanna's worshippers, there was nothing else like it on earth, nor indeed in heaven. Excavated in 1939 from a sacred deposition pit within the temple precinct, the pale marble face probably belonged to a cult statue of Inanna herself, the body of which was likely made of sacred wood, perhaps tamarisk, that had been richly carved, smoothed, and overlaid with precious materials and dressed in the finest fabrics. Positioned on a podium in her temple, Inanna would have stood higher than a human, her large-eyed, flawless face turned towards her worshippers. For Western art historians, raised on a rich European diet of Greek and Roman statuary, the face of the Lady of Uruk is especially prized for its remarkable realism. It's the earliest known work to capture in stone the naturalness of the human face, predating the high art of the classical world by millennia. But this marble face was never intended to be the lifelike image of a mere mortal. It was created instead to manifest a more expansive, imagined reality. It made visible what was usually hidden. This was the face of a goddess whose corporeal form transcended that of a human and whose divine perfection eclipsed any earthly beauty. In its heyday, the face of the Lady of Uruk was staggeringly otherworldly. Now empty sockets, her wide eyes were once alive with the pearlescent shine of seashells or mineral paste, their pupils picked out with lapis lazuli or bitumen. Her gaze was framed by the lapis that had filled her stylized brows. The carefully sculpted curls on her forehead had probably been traced in gold, and an ornate carved hairpiece or luxuriant wig fixed into the grooves and perforations on the flat back of the marble. And crowning her beauty, curving around a turban set upon her head, there had been two proud bull horns rising up from the sides of her forehead. Inanna's beautiful divinity was manifest in the composite nature of her image, its repleteness, so that substance, form, style, and ornamentation were combined in ways coded as divine. Just as our own heads and faces are prominent sites of enculturation, the parts of our bodies we especially highlight, modify, or decorate to express something of our social status, gender, occupation, age, and personhood, So too the gods were coiffed, capped, contoured and coloured by their own cultural contexts. But the enculturation of the gods went beyond our own in one important way. While modern Westerners remain wholly human without hair, a hat or jewellery, the very essence of divinity was completed or perfected by what might look to us to be mere, if elaborate, ornamentation. Replete with their cultural trappings, the gods were aesthetically perfect in form, and hence perfect in divinity. They were wholly holy. The encultured, corporeal completeness of divinity is perhaps nowhere better expressed than in a Sumerian myth about Inanna herself. It tells of her descent to the underworld, the realm ruled by her sister Ereshkigal. It's an aggressively ambitious attempt to claim the underworld for herself, and she confidently plans to defy its nature as the land of no return by leaving again. But when she arrives, she's appalled to learn that she must be ceremonially stripped of her seven powers of divinity as she passes through the seven gateways leading to her sister's throne room. At the first gate, her horned turban is removed. At the second, her lapis lazuli necklace. At the third, the string of egg-shaped beads decorating her breast. By the time she's passed through the sixth gate, she's lost her glittering pectoral, her golden finger ring, and her lapis lazuli toolkit, the measuring rod and line with which she apportions justice. Finally, at the seventh gateway, she's deprived of her robe, the garment of ladyship. Crouching and naked, she has been robbed of her upright, forthright divinity, the very essence of her heavenly personhood. She's wholly diminished. But things are about to get worse. Although she seats herself on her sister's throne, she's not there for long. The divine denizens of the underworld assault her body further. They stare at her with a look of death, they speak to her with words of anger, and they bellow at her with a shout of shame. Bludgeoned by these incantations, she's turned into a corpse, and in a nightmarish detail, her corpse is hung on a hook. But all is not lost. The wise god Enki crafts a rescue party from the clay caught under his fingernails, who retrieve Inanna's corpse from its hook and revive her with the balm of Enki's life-giving plant and a sprinkling of his life-giving water. As she leaves, Inanna secures her release with a promise that she will be replaced in the land of death by a substitute. She decides it will be her lover, the fertile shepherd god Dumuzi, who had rather foolishly failed to grieve for her sufficiently. He will spend half the year in the underworld in her place, much as Persephone will do in later Greek versions of the myth. Mournful but resolute, Inanna returns from the underworld to ornamented glory in the heavenly realm. It's within this context that the beautifying accoutrements of the gods are best understood. Every layer of divine radiance, every hairstyle and headdress, every ornament and every prop solidified and certified a deity's divinity. And the God of the Bible was no exception. It's all too easy to dismiss those brisk references to his clothing and weaponry as cartoon features of a theologically unsophisticated one-dimensional deity. But whenever we encounter God's ornamentation and accessories in the Bible, whether his headdress, robes and sandals, or weapons, measuring rod and writing equipment, we're privy to a fleeting glimpse of an ancient wardrobe essential to his divine nature. He's not simply human-like in his penchant for decoration and display, but a deity complete in divinity. From head to toe, God's bodily decorations and personal possessions were imbued with their own heavenly power, augmenting the core divinity of his body. A crown of horns. The oldest of God's bodily augmentations was the pair of bull horns crowning his head. God, who brought Israel out of Egypt, has horns like a wild ox. He destroys nations who oppose him. He crushes their bones, declares the prophet Balaam in an ancient oracle in the book of Numbers. It's an image that modern-day readers of the Bible might find unsettling. In the Western imagination, a horned being tends to conjure images of the diabolical and the grotesque. From the man-eating, bull-headed minotaur of Greek myth to the cloven-hoofed, goat-faced devil of Christianity, horns have long served as a hallmark of horror. But in the world of the very ancient gods, horns were the most prestigious and alluring manifestations of divinity, and most deities would be equipped with them. Wrapped about these heavenly horns were deeply rooted ideas about cosmic order. The gods' horns marked them out as a species innately distinct from humans. They were beings of bullish virility and ferocious strength, whose sharp, majestic weapons were built into their bodies. But the horns of the gods manifested life as well as death. They mirrored the pointed horns of the crescent moon as it waxed and waned, pulling and pushing at the great rivers watering life in the desert plains of southern Mesopotamia. It was here in Sumer that horns had first sprouted on the ancient gods as we know them. From as early as the late 4th millennium BCE, the horned cap was already the distinctive marker of divinity, so much so the loss of the horned cap could mark death for a deity. It's an idea vividly expressed on a cylinder seal showing a group of minor deities busily building a temple gate. In front of them, two higher status gods are about to perform a ritual killing. They have thick beards, neatly styled hair, and impressive bull horns stretching out and up from their headwear. Both wear the belt of a warrior around their waists. One raises his arms to the heavens as he looks at his companion, who is wielding a mace at a smaller god, crouched on the ground in submission. He wears nothing except for his beard and his horned cap, which is about to be ripped from his head. This is the violent act that will strip him of divine immortality, much as Inanna's forced undressing had led to her own temporary death. The horns of the gods were not confined to Sumer, but soon sprouted on the heads, hats, and turbans of deities across Mesopotamia, Anatolia, Syria, and the Levant, passing from one generation of gods to the next, like a genetic carrier of divinity travelling down the ages. By the middle of the second millennium BCE, the pedigreed horns of heaven were atop the head of the Levantine high god Ael, the cultural father of the god of the Bible. At Ugarit, Ael's horns were fashionably changeable depending on the skills, influences, and location of the artisans crafting his cult images. Sometimes his horns hugged the contours of his conical headdress with a graceful, controlled curve, mimicking the well-known Atef crown of the pharaohs, a tall hat framed by two long, large feathers. But sometimes Ael's horns looked as though they had sprung from his head with a sudden, wild vigour. An especially lively example is the image of Ael carved into a stela found in a private house in Ugarit. It was probably intended as an offering to the god himself, but it was never finished. The deity sits on a stylish, low-backed throne, his feet on his footstool and his arms gesticulating as though in animated conversation with the priest or king standing opposite him. Ael's horns branch out wide and high above his ears, while his crown, a tall turban, is ribbed with smaller pairs of tightly meshed horns, emphasising his supreme divinity. Like many of his peers across Southwest Asia, Ael was frequently titled bull, and he quite naturally expected his divine children to inherit his horns of divinity. "May they have horns like bulls and humps like steers," he cries when his two young wives go into labour with his offspring. His older children already bear the bull horns of heaven. Anats are particularly praised by her brother Baal, who excitedly anoints and blesses them. "The horns of your power, girl Anat, the horns of your power, let Baal anoint." As a storm deity, Baal's own horns are said to be especially radiant and closely identified with the lightning bolts flashing about his head as he moves through the skies or thunders in his mountaintop temple. Images of both deities frequently show them wearing horns, as befitting any Levantine god, but especially those associated with the storm of war or the rains of fertility. It's no surprise, then, that in the older traditions embedded in the Hebrew Bible, God himself is not only portrayed as the divine bull equipped with horns, but fully expects his own progeny to inherit them. It's an image applied to the tribe of Joseph in an ancient poem, in which God's divine blessings rain down on his son. Let them come on the head of Joseph, on the brow of the head of the prince among his brothers. The firstborn of his divine bull, majesty is his. His horns are the horns of a wild ox. With them he gores peoples, driving them to the ends of the earth. God's horns were remembered not only in ancient poems, but in the rituals and iconography of his temples too. The prophet Zedekiah ben Kenana is said to have crafted a pair of iron horns to enact Yahweh's promise to the kings of Israel and Judah that the neighbouring Arameans would be gored to death in battle. It's a tradition pointing to the widespread practice of ritualized prophetic performance, in which the diviner embodied the oracle by physically enacting the deity's decreed actions. We should probably imagine Zedekiah snorting and bellowing as he charges about the sanctuary, wearing a specially made horned headdress like those crowning the statues of gods. But in some of Yahweh's temples, the deity was not simply crowned with heavenly horns, but took the form of a divine bull. According to the books of Kings, Yahweh's temples in Bethel and Dan were each said to have housed a golden statue of a young bull god, while in the book of Hosea, a gold and silver statue of a bull was said to have been worshipped in Samaria, the capital of the kingdom of Israel. Despite his exasperated critique of worshippers fawning over the statue, the prophet can barely disguise the clear implication that it manifested the city's patron deity, Yahweh of Samaria himself. These statues might have been similar in style to the little bronze bull archaeologists found at an older 12th century BCE shrine in the hill country in which the kingdom of Israel would emerge. Or perhaps they look more like the bull-headed warrior god portrayed on an 8th century BCE stela from the nearby Aramean city of Bethsaida. Either way, Yahweh's militarized bull horns were particularly venerated in the religious iconography of his most powerful northern temples, which made these statues an obvious target for derision after Assyria captured them and looted the kingdom of Israel in the 8th century BCE. In his description of the kingdom's conquest, the Assyrian king Sargon II refers to the cult statues taken into captivity. "I counted as spoiled 27,280 people, together with their chariots and the gods in whom they trusted." Looking back at the humiliating calamity that had befallen their northern neighbours, later scribes in Jerusalem deliberately cast the statues in these rival temples simply as abominable images of an animal, giving rise to the story of the infamous golden calf of Sinai. These scribes naturally imagined that Yahweh had been as appalled by his animalized presence as they were. "They exchanged my glory for the image of a bull that feeds on grass," he is later said to have spluttered. Why else, scribes reasoned, would the deity have abandoned his northern worshippers to foreign invasion? God's horned headdress would gradually fade from view, leaving only glancing traces in the biblical literature, including the horns sprouting from the forehead of his most venerable representative, Moses. But God's beauty was undiminished. Like the horns worn by his divine forebears, the horned hat of Yahweh had towered over a face carefully calibrated to exhibit the alluring aesthetics of heavenly perfection. And it was his face that would continue to entrance his worshippers. Desiring the Divine. "One thing I asked of Yahweh that I will seek ever after, to live in the house of Yahweh all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of Yahweh. Your face, Yahweh, I do seek." Sighing with longing, the author of these love lyrics in the book of Psalms yearns to dwell in the Jerusalem temple and feast his eyes on God, a deity so alluring that adoration borders on desire. This ancient poet was not the only one to be swept up by God's beauty. "Praise Yahweh, for he is lovely looking," another psalmist cries. "Praise Yah, for Yahweh is good looking," yet another exclaims. In these songs of worship, God's aesthetic qualities are more usually veiled in translation by the mistaken assumption that no one believed God had a body to be seen. his magnetic good looks are recast instead as immaterial moral virtues, so that in most Bibles today, God is described not as good-looking, but good. He's not lovely-looking, but gracious. And yet the Hebrew terms used in these psalms, Tov and Na'im, carry with them a strong sense of the aesthetic, and they're often used to describe attractive people, pretty places, and wondrous sights, rather than abstract qualities. God may well have embodied praiseworthy values, but he was also staggeringly beautiful. This was a world in which beauty was perceived in the purity or intensity of its forms, the clarity of shape, the richness of colour, the brightness of light, the heaviness of scent. But the beauty of form was not to be distinguished from the beauty of function. From temple architecture to the good looks of the gods, beauty was as much about role, status, purpose, and action as shape, colour, tone, and composition. Whether an alluring being or an attractive building, an encounter with beauty was an emotional experience, overwhelming whoever was lucky enough to behold it. In this sense, beauty was understood not as a passive abstraction, but as a divinely derived, otherworldly intoxicant, so that even the most surprising objects could give rise to a deep desire dancing on that fine line between religious magnetism and physical attraction. This is precisely what Gilgamesh is said to have experienced when he had a dream about an unusual copper axe seemingly fallen from heaven. Describing the dream the next morning, he's overwhelmed by his desire for the extraordinarily alluring object. "I saw it and I felt such joy. I loved it as a woman," he tells his mother. Power tools were clearly as coveted in Gilgamesh's world as they are to some in our own. But Gilgamesh's desire for the axe was no workshed fetish. It was a deeply emotional response to a purposeful object of such perfection in both form and function that he could not help but fall in love with it. Like Gilgamesh, the god of the Bible had himself experienced the powerful allure of beautiful things. In Genesis, the deity finishes creating the world and then takes a moment to admire his handiwork. He saw everything that he had made, and indeed it was very beautiful. The sense of this verse is that God himself marvelled both at the workings of the world and its attractive form. Even in God's garden, the fruit of the forbidden tree, set apart for God alone, was not only to be desired for the wisdom it would impart, but because it was pleasant tasting and a delight to the eyes. The garden itself is named Delight, Eden, and it is the language of delight that Yahweh often uses to express his physical attraction to beautiful things, just as his love song to the rebuilt Jerusalem, personified as his bride, vividly describes. "You should be a crown of beauty in Yahweh's hand and a royal diadem in the hand of your God. You should be called, 'My delight is in her,' and your land, 'Wedded one,' for Yahweh delights in you and your land shall be married. For as a young man marries a young woman, so shall your builder marry you." Beauty was in the gift of the gods, and so the appeal of Yahweh's holy city, the delights of his garden, and the beauty of the created world were derived from the deity himself, for he was the artisan who had crafted them. And nothing could compare to the staggering beauty of Yahweh himself. As one early Jewish poet would soon come to put it, "Much better than these is their Lord, for the author of beauty created them." Something of Yahweh's astonishing good looks can be glimpsed in the description of the most beautiful man in the Bible. He's found in the Song of Songs, where a young woman cannot help but use the sensuous language of awestruck wonder to explain exactly why her lover is so deliciously desirable. "My beloved is radiant and ruddy, standing out among 10,000. His head is gold, pure gold. His locks are curls, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves by watercourses, bathed in milk, fitly set. His cheeks like beds of spices, pouring forth perfumes. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. His arms are rounded gold, inlaid with jewels. His genitalia are fine-worked ivory, with inlaid lapis lazuli. His legs are alabaster columns set upon bases of gold. Like Lebanon is his look, choice as the cedars. His mouth is sweet, and all of him desirable. Here is a beautiful man exhibiting the facial features long admired by both men and women across the ancient Levantine and Mesopotamian worlds. And yet, adorned in gold and jewels and anointed with fragrant oils, the woman's lover is no ordinary man. He's not even an Adonis. He's a divine statue in a temple. He is a god. This is the way in which some early rabbis understood these ancient love lyrics. For them, the overwhelming beauty of that ruddy face and muscular body, that black lustrous hair and perfumed beard, his cheeks like beds of spices, could only be understood as their beautiful god who had first revealed himself to their ancestors as they fled Egypt. The deity who had dwelt among them in sacred space adorned with the gleaming treasures and spiced scents of worship. The youthful god for whom Solomon had built the Jerusalem temple. In seeing God in this poem, the rabbis were not simply wrestling prized love lyrics into a new theological form, but drawing on a deeply ingrained cultural memory of the beauty of Yahweh. God's beauty incorporated those features traditionally associated with idealized masculine beauty, reddened skin, thick locks of dark hair, and a carefully styled beard. One of the most exquisite examples of masculine divine beauty was found at the city of Ur. Excavations revealed a painted terracotta statuette of an enthroned god, which had once been positioned before a small altar in a house in a wealthy residential area. Crafted sometime between 1850 and 1750 BCE, the deity wears a magnificent multi-tiered horned hat, coloured yellow to represent the shiny gold of the horned crowns adorning divine statues in the city's temples. The skin of his face and body has been painted a rich red, and his hair a deep black, a shade conflated with the dark blue hues of lapis lazuli, which coloured the hair of the gods. Neat, tight curls sit on his forehead, while larger ringlets, loosely pinned at the nape of his neck, fall behind his shoulders. His facial hair is a geometrically patterned thatch of more tight black curls, his thick, tidy sideburns meeting the sculpted moustache and impressive beard hugging his mouth. Although his beard extends well beyond his chin and onto his chest, its length is tamed into immaculate, zigzagged locks, as though carefully crimped. He wears a wide, flat necklace, painted yellow and red to represent gold-set gemstones, and his left shoulder is draped with a white robe decorated with black lines. Although this small statue predates the God of the Bible by several centuries, its features would remain typical of masculine beauty across Mesopotamia and the Levant. And one of the most alluring markers of the god's magnetic masculinity was ruddy red, shining skin. Underlying this colour symbolism were the enlivening red pigments that had been used for millennia to transform special objects into living beings, and living beings into supercharged forces, much as the red tints given to Neolithic plastered skulls might suggest. This age-old aesthetic found its way into the religions of subsequent societies across the broader region, so that divine bodies were generally understood to be red. It was a ruddiness of ritual power. In Egypt, the red resins used in mummification processes transformed a corpse into a newly living being. In Mesopotamia, the ideal material for statues of the gods was reddish gold, which manifested the blazing divine light of their radiant skin. If the reddened skins of the gods manifested their otherworldly vitality, it also signalled their alluring virility and terrifying ferocity. In a world in which an overtly masculine sex appeal was mapped closely onto idealised tropes of aggressive virility and physical dominance, red-stained skin was particularly associated with what's best described as warrior erotica. Before going into battle, fighters might ritually prepare their bodies by staining their skin red, empowering them not only with the life-giving and death-bringing colour of blood, but with the ruddy hues of the clay from which the first earthly life was created and to which all mortals returned in death. Ready to penetrate bodies on the battlefield, red-stained warriors marked themselves out as masters of mortality, sparing or severing lives like the divine patrons they served. Sexually irresistible and yet deadly dangerous, these intimidating fighters channeled the charismatic beauty of the gods. The sex appeal of the red-stained warrior was especially divinized in the bodies of the goddesses for whom they fought. Unencumbered by the more rigid gender roles of mortals, many goddesses were themselves fierce fighters whose magnetic sexuality straddled both masculine and feminine ideals, giving expression to a gender queerness or fluidity more hesitantly explored in other aspects of society. In Mesopotamia, the goddess Ishtar, Inanna, was a favourite among warriors. She was not only celebrated for the beauty of her face, the entrancing gaze of her eyes, and the sweet-scented, warm wetness of her vulva, but also for her terrifying brute force in battle, her superlative martial skills, and her voraciously masculine appetite for sex. Known in Sumerian literature as She of the Red Face, the goddess was closely identified with the red hues of cosmic forces, from the red gold of her skin and the magic carnelian stones she particularly prized, to the red skies of the morning and evening when her celestial body, the planet we know as Venus, was at its brightest. Like Ishtar, the ferocious Levantine goddess Anat had a reputation for both a very feminine beauty and a hyper-masculine violence. She, too, was the deity most beloved of local warriors, who inscribed her name on their arrowheads and counted themselves her sons and servants. In Ugaritic mythology, Anat is the goddess who not only reddens her body bathing in the blood of her enemies, but after purifying herself, she colours her skin with a red cosmetic to make herself even more sexually alluring. It's a bodily transformation also undertaken by a beautiful woman called Pukat, who mimics Anat's dangerous sex appeal by staining her body red, donning the clothing and weapons of war, and throwing her womanly robe over the top as she sets out to captivate and assassinate the killer of her beloved brother. This ruddy, charismatic beauty and bloody empowerment was well known to the God of the Bible. He not only commands his mortal fighters to adorn their skin, belts, and sandals with blood, but is himself the alluring red-stained warrior, handsomely clothed in blood when he returns from battle in the book of Isaiah. When a sentry in Jerusalem spots the deity striding home from trampling his enemies in the red desert sands of Edom, he asks, "Who is this so splendidly robed?" His question is no mere formality. It's the exclamation of a man stunned at the sight of a beautiful blood-soaked warrior, a reaction Plutarch would similarly report of the women of Sparta, who realise their own victorious king, Acrotatus, is even better looking, drenched in blood. Yahweh's prophets were just as bowled over by the terrifying glamour of blood-red warriors. Nahum can barely contain his excitement in his heavily sexualized account of the destruction of Nineveh in 612 BCE. "The shields of his warriors are red. His soldiers are clothed in crimson," he gushes. "The battering ram has come up against you. Gird your loins," he cries, using a turn of phrase that might be more literally rendered, "harden your balls." Even God himself is unmanned by the sexualized threat of invading armies when he accuses his abused wife, Jerusalem, of lusting after the desirable young men of invading armies who are clad in vermilion. Not that Yahweh's own head had never been turned by the godlike beauty of a good-looking man. Having seen that the young shepherd boy David was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was good-looking, Yahweh promptly decided to set him up as king. "Anoint him, this is the one." God was not the only one to fall for the beautiful young man. David's enticing appeal not only captivated Michal, the daughter of King Saul, but Saul's son and heir, the warrior Jonathan, who takes an erotically charged delight in David, and whose love for him, David famously declares, was greater than the love of a woman. Like the ruddy divine statue envisaged in the Song of Songs, David exhibits the same irresistible, sexually potent masculinity of a beautiful warrior. Today, we may not have the remnants of a polychrome statue of Yahweh, but we can come face to face with a deity or divinized being who looked very much like him. Excavations have revealed a number of striking limestone heads from the Iron Age kingdom of the Ammonites, just across the river from ancient Israel and Judah, in what's now northern Jordan. Dated from the 9th to the 7th centuries BCE, many of these heads once topped the statues of venerable dead kings, divinized in the afterlife. But some look decidedly higher status in their divinity, and are likely the high god Milcom, the patron deity of Ammonite kings, and Yahweh's opposite number. Time has not been kind to these artifacts, but something of their allure remains, an allure most forcefully emanating from one particular example now on prominent public display in Jerusalem's Israel Museum. And yet it's a scandal that this divine face can even be seen at all. Illegally excavated in or around Amman, Jordan, in the mid-20th century, this artifact was likely smuggled into Israel, where it spent several years sitting on a bookshelf in the home of Moshe Dayan, 1915-81, a high-ranking Israeli politician, military leader, and notoriously corrupt antiquities collector. Untrained and unethical in his archaeological endeavours, Dayan looted, traded, and illegally excavated his way to amassing a vast collection of artifacts from ancient sites across the Middle East, as detailed in Raz Kletter's important 2003 article in the Journal of Hebrew Scriptures. While Dayan claimed to have acquired a number of pieces as gifts, in his 1978 book Living with the Bible, he states he had bought the Ammonite head from a dealer in Jerusalem. To the best of my knowledge, nothing of this artifact's recent life is explicitly communicated to visitors to the Israel Museum beyond the acknowledgement that it forms a part of the Moshe Dayan collection. One among a number of unprovenance pieces controversially acquired by the museum, this artifact's status is tainted by its sordid journey into public view. But its divine beauty is still arresting. Traces of a vibrant red pigment stain the deity's face and neck. Large eyes, now empty of their bright inlays, are set beneath patterned eyebrows arching across his forehead, their delicate hairs feathered like the fine veins of a green leaf. A neat, combed moustache stretches over his mouth, and a luxuriant beard, tamed into beautiful, elongated curls, hugs his cheeks and chin. Clay representations of gemstones, suspended from the small hoops he wears in his ears, are nestled in his thick corkscrew locks of hair. On his head is a tall horned crown, its band blossoming with flowers. Virility, fertility, ferocity, and majesty are the hallmarks of his beauty. And it was a beauty once reflected in the face of Yahweh himself. Godly grooming. Whether mortal or divine, a male face framed and furnished with lustrous hair manifested masculine virility and physical dominance. This cultural marker of bodily power was so pervasive that a goddess or a queen might occasionally don a ceremonial prosthetic beard to underscore her own supremacy. Just as the hair of goddesses might be described as the leaves of a palm tree or flowing water, and their pubic hair as a flock of ducks or lush lettuces, the luxuriant hair of the gods manifested the fertile abundance of the natural world in all its generative, precious forms. In Mesopotamian literature, Marduk's hair is a cultivated field, his topknot is a tamarisk, and his beard a frond. On other male deities, hairy armpits are described as leeks, chest hair is a thornbush, and pubic hair is boxwood. Across ancient Southwest Asia, hairiness had long been associated with an unfettered hypermasculinity and a correspondingly raw sexuality. In early Mesopotamian art, the ferocious strength and untamed sexuality of the semi-divine heroes of old was evident in their long locks of hair springing from their heads in six curling ropes as they wrestled ferocious monsters and wild beasts. They looked very much like the appropriately named Lahmu, Hairy, a minor deity who guarded the foundations and doorways of buildings from demonic attack. In Mesopotamian myth, the ultimate hairy warrior was Enkidu, the wild man created by the gods to distract the semi-divine warrior king Gilgamesh from brawling and bedding his way through the exhausted population of his city. Enkidu embodied the fertile wildness of the supreme warrior. His whole body was shaggy with hair, he was furnished with tresses like a woman, his locks of hair grew luxuriant like grain. It's only once a beautiful sex worker called Shamhat has taught Enkidu to eat bread instead of grass, to have languid, pleasurable sex rather than rutting like an animal, and to engage in some personal grooming that he's sufficiently civilized for urban life with Gilgamesh. Enkidu's newly tamed hair scares the wild animals with whom he had once roamed, for Enkidu had stripped his hair, his body was too clean. His transformation into a beautiful warrior is complete. "You are handsome," exclaims Shamhat. "You are just like a god." Civilized but hegemonic masculinity was a powerfully hairy man, appropriately coiffed and styled, his powerful control of the world matched by the taming and styling of his long hair and magnificent beard. The celebrated palace reliefs of late Assyrian kings illustrate well the cultural value of male grooming. Whether a god or a king, the mightiest men of the Assyrian world wear their shoulder-length hair in tight curls, carefully pinned or plaited into disciplined shape. Their upper cheeks are neatly shaved, their short, sculpted sideburns and tidy moustaches delineated with patterned precision. Their long beards, sitting on their broad chests, are sharply squared off and intricately styled into a crosshatch of curled rows and columns. This not only gives their faces an architectural aesthetic of geometric precision, but mimics the interlocking bark leaves of the date palm tree, which stood at the symbolic heart of religious and economic life in Mesopotamia. By deliberate contrast, eunuchs are beardless, while dead or captive enemies either wear much shorter, rounded, or dishevelled beards, or are humiliatingly barefaced. The biblical writers, too, were familiar with the power and politics of male grooming. One of the most famous heroes of ancient Israel and Judah is the long-haired Samson, whose story is told in the book of Judges. He is the child born to be set apart for special service to Yahweh. "You will conceive and bear a son," a divine messenger tells Samson's unnamed mother, "and no razor will pass over his head, for the boy will be a Nazir of God from the womb." As a Nazir, Samson is to be classed among a special group of temporary dedications to Yahweh, living, unsacrificed offerings to the deity, whose displacement from mainstream society was marked by their uncut hair, their holiness growing like their lengthening locks. "When locks grow long in Israel, when people richly offer themselves willingly, bless Yahweh," ran an ancient song. But Samson is remembered not so much for his religious service, but his superhuman strength. Like Enkidu, the wild man of Mesopotamian myth, Samson's hypermasculinity is marked by his long hair. He's the strong man who kills a lion with his bare hands, slaughters 1,000 men with a donkey bone, and carries a city gate on his shoulders. Unlike Enkidu, however, Samson is born a man of culture. He wears his long hair in 7 plaits, braided and bound into order. His emasculation comes at the hands of his girlfriend, Delilah, who arranges for his hair to be shaved clean off by enemy Philistines while he sleeps in her lap. Baldness brings powerlessness, both physical and divine. Yahweh abandons him, as does his superhuman strength. Imprisoned, shackled, blinded and shaved, Samson is as helpless as a swaddled, bareheaded newborn. But as his hair grows back, Samson's powerful masculinity returns. Brought up from his prison as party entertainment at a temple festival, he is chained and displayed between two giant columns like a stricken, baited bear, his long hair untamed and unbound. Samson brings the pillars of the Philistine temple crashing down upon his enemies, killing himself in the process. In a sense, his story ends much as Enkidu's had begun. With the return of Samson's long hair comes a raw, dehumanized and deadly wildness, set in stark opposition to the socialized sophistication of city living. Yahweh's apparent preference for carefully groomed, long-haired, bearded mortal men went beyond Samson. His priests were instructed not to shave their heads, cut back the hair on their cheeks, nor remove their sideburns, not even in grief, when men commonly divested themselves of their ordinary clothing and stripped themselves of their vivifying hair in solidarity with their rotting dead. It was a mourning custom Ael himself had performed on learning of the death of Baal. He poured the ashes of mourning on his head, the dust of grovelling on his skull. For clothing he put on a loincloth, his skin with a stone he scored, his sidelocks with a razor. He cut his hairy cheeks and chin. It's a remarkable display of ritual self-abasement, for the deliberate shortening or shaving of a senior god's beard might sap his strength, stripping the deity of his authority as well as his masculinity. It was a widespread cultural anxiety, powerfully attested by a much earlier Mesopotamian cylinder seal, showing one god, horn-capped and heavily robed, mutilating the beard of another. This form of emasculating mutilation was well known to kings across Southwest Asia, whose law codes regularly decreed that political enemies, rebellious vassals, and domestic criminals would be divested of those body parts most closely associated with generative power. The hair, beard, hands, and genitals would be chopped off. In the Hebrew Bible, Yahweh levels a similar threat against his own people. Virtually brandishing a razor blade, he warns he will join the king of Assyria in cutting his people down to shameful size. The Lord will shave with a razor hired beyond the Euphrates River with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the feet or genitals, and the beard too, it will take off. Humiliatingly, Yahweh's male worshippers will not only lose their hair and their beards, but they will be shorn of their pubic hair too. The God of the Bible clearly understood that a carefully groomed beard and a thick head of hair were potent markers of masculine virility. Not that he was necessarily insensitive to the potential socio-sexual humiliation inherent in natural male baldness, as his prophet Elisha was pleased to discover. According to a collection of folk tales in the books of Kings, Elisha might have inherited Elijah's hairy animal skin cloak, but it failed to make up for his baldness. When he's teased by a gang of small boys, "Go away, baldy, go away, baldy," he might as well have been mocked for erectile dysfunction. But Yahweh heeds Elisha's calls for a curse to fall upon the children and responds with a sardonic, gender-bending flourish. Two hairy she-bears suddenly appear and attack the children, shredding a staggering 42 of them. Given the cultural cachet of long, lustrous hair and muscular beardedness among divine and mortal men, it's almost unthinkable that Yahweh himself, the paradigmatic alpha male, could ever have been imagined to be bald-headed or beard-free. Before the cultural upheavals following the destruction of the kingdom of Judah in the 6th century BCE, his hair and beard was probably imagined to look very much like that of the mortal kings who ruled in his name. As the earthly doppelganger of the heavenly king, the authority of the human king rested on his ideological or schematic likeness to Yahweh in both form and function, So much so, one psalmist could describe the mortal king as a divine being and the most beautiful of men, forever blessed by God. And a remarkable image of a king of Judah offers a tantalizing glimpse of this divinely derived royal beauty. Inked in red and black on a potsherd, the ancient equivalent of notepaper, it had likely served as an artist's preparatory sketch for a more costly image. Dated to the 7th century BCE, the potsherd was uncovered during the excavation of what is thought to be a royal residence in Ramat Rachel, just north of Bethlehem. It depicts a wide-eyed, muscular man, richly robed and sitting on an ornate throne, a benevolent smile dancing at his mouth. Thick, carefully groomed locks of hair fall to his shoulders, and his long black beard is shaped into a thrusting point, a style common to artistic representations of elite males across the southern Levant. In an age in which portraiture was highly unusual, this was not so much a portrayal of a specific ruler, but a recognisable representation of Judahite kingship, embodied by the requisite physical features of that alluring, idealized masculinity kings shared with their gods. If this little painting offered a mortal mirroring of the face of Yahweh, 300 years later, another would reveal the face of the deity himself. A storeroom in the British Museum is now home to a small silver coin, minted in the first half of the 4th century BCE in or around Judah, which was now a Persian satrapy called Yehud. The obverse shows the profile of the local Persian governor, stereotypically presented as a bearded military man wearing a crested helmet. On the reverse of the coin is a muscular god wearing an ankle-length tunic or cloak. He's seated on a winged wheel, an emblem which had come to be used of solar high gods across the Eastern Mediterranean and the Levant. One hand rests comfortably on his lap, but the other is stretched out in front of him, a hunting bird perched on his hand. The god has thick side locks, a shapely beard, and a luxuriant head of hair. Neatly styled and pinned, it reaches almost to his shoulders. Behind the god and his bird, the word Yehud, Judah, is inscribed in Aramaic, the language dominating commerce and administration in the western half of the empire. The coin was produced at a time when minting workshops in the southern Levant tended to imitate or adapt motifs influenced by the Greek, Phoenician, and Egyptian imagery commonly found on money, weights, and tokens across the wider region. But this example was locally produced for use in Judah itself, where the coin's constellation of symbols would have left little doubt about the identity of the seated deity on the coin's reverse. Adopting the now widespread Hellenized pose of the supreme god of the heavens, and sitting alongside the name of his homeland, it is Yahweh himself. To his worshippers in Judah, his winged wheel was easily identified both with Yahweh's winged chariot throne and the winged solar disk which had long served as a religious emblem of the former kingdom of Judah. In contrast to the mysterious, balding head and unkempt whiskers of the bulbous-nosed, aging face positioned at his feet, a face that continues to baffle scholars, Yahweh is adorned with the thick hair and groomed beard of an attractively vigorous, virile deity. On this coin, the deity's traditional long locks and pointed black beard might well have morphed in style from distinctively Levantine to fashionably Greek, but it was a relatively minor wardrobe alteration. Over the course of the first millennium BCE, from its early centuries to the dawning of the Hellenistic era, the proud horns adorning Yahweh's head had already faded from view, and his youthful, ruddy beauty had matured into a seemingly more rugged, battle-stained glamour. But an even bigger change to God's good looks was on its way. He was about to go grey.